Any preliminary questions or issues? Okay, then we finished yesterday with kind of a general introduction to the idea of proximate cause, where its place is in a larger scheme of things. And sort of the bottom line was that proximate cause has these two aspects or elements. One is the idea that the defendant's breach of duty, but more commonly the defendant's negligence, was a cause without which the injury would not have occurred, the so-called but-for cause requirement. And the second one, that the relationship between the defendant's negligence and the plaintiff's injury is such that it's fair to impose liability and thus satisfies the requirement of legal cause. And we're going to wind up taking each of these sort of on their own terms because they really operate fairly independently of one another. You can meet one and not the other and vice versa. So that's what we're going to do, starting today with the beginning of but-for cause. And to kind of illustrate the problem, we have this first case of Hull versus Merck. Who's is Matapour feeling neglected? Go ahead. Okay, so the plaintiff's working in this some kind of waste disposal aspect of it, or the piping to get rid of the stuff. And while he's working there, apparently he's doused with these hazardous chemicals. And what happens to him? Okay. So again, we've got, and let's assume for purposes of our discussion that what the defendants did in this case was negligent, satisfied in effect our Chapter 1 issue. Chapter 3 issue, what are his damages? He's got leukemia. Again, let's assume that all of those aspects are satisfied. What we're missing here, at least what's in question, is Chapter 2. Was it proximately caused, was his leukemia proximately caused by the defendant's negligent release of these chemicals? Okay, so where do we go in terms of the history of the case here? Well, he files suit claiming that they're responsible for his leukemia. And what happens to this lawsuit? Okay, and let's just pause there for a moment to reflect on the fact that sometimes the causation issue is a matter of sort of observation or something in our everyday experience, that somebody's going too fast, allegedly, and then they rear end somebody else, and the excessive speed is alleged to have caused the rear end collision. And we have enough experience watching the way cars operate so that we can figure out what the relationship is between speed and rear-end collisions. On the other hand, in this case, the question of whether or not his exposure to this chemical caused the leukemia is not something that we have kind of everyday experience with. So the plaintiff hires this expert, and what is the expert's conclusion? What specifically were those assumptions? I don't quite understand that second assumption. That seems a little bit odd, doesn't it, that I thought that's what we hired him to find out. Okay, so what does the trial judge do when it's pointed out to the trial judge that the expert has reached the conclusion that his leukemia was caused by his exposure to this chemical, but when he's pressed, how did you arrive at that conclusion, doctor? He says, well, I assumed. You know, assuming the moon is made of green cheese, then the moon is made of green cheese. That's a logical statement, and within its parameters, it's incontrovertible. But it hasn't provided us any useful information. The trial judge excluded it. Now, what do you suppose might have been the kind of testimony that would have been admitted? What could the doctor have done other than what he did to reach a conclusion that would have been admissible to the jury? But we may even know that. We may know that there were, 60 gallons of benzene that he was exposed to this for 2.5 hours and he wasn't decontaminated for another hour and a half and so forth and so on. But what we need to know is what's the relationship between that and his subsequent leukemia. Okay. There are no other ways that you can get leukemia, but I don't think that's true. People get leukemia who've never been exposed to this chemical. Is there any way? Right. You have scientific research out there. This is, of course, a not uncontroversial area, so that when people say that, for example, what is the health risk associated with something like living near strong electromagnetic forces? If you live right underneath a power thing, the transformer where it's switching electricity from one voltage to another, and it generates an electromagnetic current, or you have a high voltage line where you can stand underneath the high voltage line and it'll make a fluorescent tube glow. Does that damage people's health? Or more recently, the question about whether breast implants caused health problems. Lots and lots of women sued Dow Corning saying that before the breast implant, their health was fine. After the breast implant, they had all kinds of problems. And the allegation was that the implant caused the problems. How do we go about determining what the relationship is between these two events? We do scientific studies, but the methodology of those scientific studies is not, as I say, uncontroversial. Let me take another example outside the tort area, but it illustrates the nature of the problem. About 10 or 15 years ago, there was a study by an economist named Ehrlich. I can't remember his first name. But he did a study in which he claimed that where the death penalty was imposed, murder rates were reduced by a significant factor. I forget what the percentage reduction was, but his argument was that if you have the death penalty, you will have fewer murders. his study, in turn, was vigorously challenged by other social scientists who questioned the methodology he had used and said either you can't determine this or in fact the relationship is just the opposite. The imposition of the death penalty actually creates a climate in which people are more likely to commit murder. Does it matter? Now, in the criminal law area, whether the death penalty is a good thing or a bad thing may be driven not by a perception of what effect it has on society, but on whether it in itself is right or wrong. But people may be influenced by their perception that either this has the effect of making me safer or in fact, making my life more dangerous. Inquiring minds want to know, but we can't, there is no agreement among scholars, or anybody else for that matter, as to whether or not there is an empirical relationship on that issue. Now, as I say, that's not tort related, but in all kinds of areas of tort law, there are similar kinds of fights. Sometimes, for example, with respect to asbestos exposure, people who get a particular kind of disease called mesothelioma, where the lining of their lungs becomes cancerous, and this cancer of the lining of the lungs, mesothelioma, is a deadly disease, that is, I think, almost exclusively related to asbestos exposure. The only people who get this disease are people who have asbestos exposure, and nobody without that gets it. So you basically know a person who had this exposure gets that. You know, if they have that disease, it was caused by asbestos exposure. By contrast, things like lung cancer, some people get lung cancer who are not smokers, people who get lung cancer who've not been exposed to asbestos, but smoking and asbestos exposure, the former more so than the latter, are risk factors for getting lung cancer. How do we know that when somebody dies of lung cancer that it was caused either by or both? Again, these technical questions, difficult scientific questions about which people debate, at some point comes down to a trial court deciding whether this guy died of leukemia because of his exposure to this chemical or because of some other cause. Now, the point of the the bottom line for the legal test we use is only to say you have to prove this to the jury's satisfaction more probably than not. And one of the criticisms brought by defendants, chemical companies and product manufacturers and other kinds of defendants who face these toxic exposure tort suits, they complain about something they call junk science, where experts are offered to the jury who claim to know these things in the same way that people claim to know whether the death penalty reduces the rate of murder. It's an interesting scientific question, and it's not irrelevant, but the question is this really suited for a jury? So when you have the retired school teacher and the guy who works at the tire shop and a school crossing guard and these are the people who sit on your jury, and they're looking at regression equations and scatter plots and so forth, and listening to these PhDs debate issues about causation, the defendants say, in effect, this is crazy. Our fate's being decided by these folks. But that is the system that we have. And again, the standard for the trial judge in allowing expert testimony is not, does the expert have an opinion with which everybody agrees, but does the expert have an opinion that is based upon scientific research that might help the jury decide this case? And if the defendant doesn't like the testimony, go find your own expert and persuade the jury that they ought not to believe the plaintiff's expert. Now, again, the plaintiff in this case didn't even meet that minimal standard because the expert hadn't done any research. The expert didn't say, I've looked at the exposure of benzene, I've read 17 articles on the correlation between benzene exposure and leukemia, I've looked at this guy's medical files, I've looked at his prior life history, and in my professional judgment, this amount of benzene exposure caused his leukemia. Cross-examine me if you like. What about, you know, a Johnson and Smith's 1980 study where blah, 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 fine, go at it, but that would be admissible testimony. And again, the plaintiffs argue that a jury is entitled to hear that and make a determination on that basis. The defendants say, junk science. And one of the things as you get involved in this, to the extent that in one form or another you get drawn into looking at cases involving potential risk, exposure, potential of lawsuits like this, if the company that you represent makes products that people accuse of being a risk factor in some kind of long-term disease. If you're talking about people with carpal tunnel syndrome who sit at keyboards all day, or you know, other kinds of, you know, exposure from cathode ray tubes, before people got LCD screens, there's probably some new disease that's related to that. As people begin to sue over various kinds of health conditions, the relevance of this kind of testimony becomes very significant in figuring out how to present this testimony on behalf of injured plaintiffs or refuting it on behalf of defendants who deny their responsibility for that. That's a big part of any tort practice. Okay, questions about Hull versus Merck and the basic principle that's there? Let's talk about Mrs. Reynolds then for a moment. Mr. Brown? Judged a 3.8 in difficulty. Yes, okay. Okay, meanwhile. So she sues the railroad claiming what? Okay, and what happens at trial? Who wins the case at trial? Okay, so the jury returns a verdict in her favor, and the defendant appeals. What's the basis of the defendant's appeal? And let's pursue that concept for a moment. But let's suppose the railroad's lawyer is cross-examining Mrs. Reynolds. She's described, you know, how they told her to hurry up, and her eyes were still, you know, pupils were not dilated, but, you know, she couldn't, it was extremely dark, but instead of being able to wait till her eyes adjusted or to make her way slowly down the stairs, she was told to hurry, and when she tried to hurry, she fell. Okay, so she's told all this, and then she's described all the injuries, or Chapter 3 stuff about the scope of her damages and how it's affected her life and so forth and so on. So they finish with her direct testimony, and then the railroad lawyer gets up and cross-examines her, and he asks her questions along these lines. He says, well, now, Mrs. Reynolds, you claim that that you fell because you couldn't see very well. Is that correct? Yes. And it was because you didn't have enough light. Is that correct? Yes. Well, tell me, Mrs. Reynolds, have you ever fallen before? You mean before I fell down? Yeah. Well, yeah, I have. Well, could you describe a couple of those occasions? Well, let's see. I was at a church picnic one time, and I had some stuff in my hand, and there was a tree root that I couldn't see underneath my feet, and I caught it on my shoe, and I fell. Well, what was the light like that day? Oh, it was bright sunshine. Oh, can you tell me about another time when you fell? Well, I was going down to the basement to get a can of peaches, and I fell. Well, was there good lighting going down? Yeah. And yet you fell anyway, isn't that right, Mrs. Reynolds? Yes. So what you're telling me is sometimes, even when you have plenty of light, you still fall, right? Yeah. So isn't it possible that even with plenty of light here, you might have fallen anyway? Yes. Your Honor, I move for a directed verdict, since she's just admitted that we don't know whether the lack of light caused her fall. How would you rule on that motion? Yeah. Or doesn't exclude a finding for the plaintiff. And the key word there is possibility. Because remember the standard that we're imposing here. We're not asking the plaintiff to show us to a moral certainty. We know this never would have happened in the absence of the defendant's negligence. We're just saying, more probably than not, as you look back on this situation, would the defendants having used reasonable care have made a difference? Not to a moral certainty, but more probably than not. She can admit it's possible that I would have fallen anyway, even if there had been good light. But I don't think so. I think, more probably than not, I would have made it down the stairs. Now, she's not talking in terms of probability, but again, there is all we're looking for is in effect, a probability, more so than not, that she would have made it safely down the stairs. Some probability she would have fallen anyway is acceptable, because we're not looking for moral certainty here, we're only looking for more probable than not. Johnson? Yeah, I mean, there again, the question of whether or not the bulb had burned out or they didn't have, they didn't light it, it may even be their negligence in telling her to hurry. That in view of the fact that they didn't have good lighting there, a reasonable person would have allowed her time for her eyes to adjust, and as she's can't see very well, to make her way down the stairs. So, again, we're sort of assuming that you can establish negligence. The question here is, can we connect the dots between the negligent act and the injury? Okay, so, again, just by way of review here, the standard that we have is a fairly simple one. It's not all that complicated. It's simply saying, does the jury believe, more probably than not, this accident would not have happened but for the defendant's negligence? And in lots of cases, as I've said before, it's not even something you spend much time thinking about. If the defendant is alleged to have run a red light, didn't stop when the light turned yellow, and instead tried to make it through the intersection, and by the time the defendant went through the intersection, the plaintiff had a green light, started out, and then got hit by the defendant. In a case like that, if you're satisfied that the defendant indeed tried to get through the intersection after the light had turned red, then it's not difficult at all to conclude, well, but for the failure of the defendant to stop, the plaintiff would not have been struck in the middle of the intersection. Proximate cause is a non-issue in a case like that. All the action centers around whether or not the defendant acted negligently. By contrast, there are other cases like Hull versus Merck where, gee, the causation issue is very significant. Maybe the defendant was negligent in exposing this guy for 6 hours to some hazardous chemical, but how do we know that that caused the plaintiff's later injury? So, again, in figuring out what sort of evidence is relevant, how you would go about satisfying people that this connection has been made. Sometimes it's a technical question, sometimes it's a purely intuitive question. So, for example, in your law school careers, or as you sit here today, you may look back at some event that happened in your life, someone who helped you get through college when you were strapped for money and somebody generously loaned you or gave you some money so you could finish your college education, or some influential teacher who encouraged you in some way that made you want to go to law school, and you could say of that event or of that person, gee, but for that person or that event, I wouldn't be here today. Or you may say, nah, you know, it helped. I mean, maybe I got through a semester sooner, but hey, I was going to law school anyway. Again, all the time we look back at things in the past and try to draw connections and say, what things made a difference? You know, if Kazuhiro Sasaki had let somebody else carry his bags upstairs, would the Mariners be in the playoffs? Some people firmly believe that. Again, these are questions about which it's not so much a doctrinal issue as it is simply a question about what facts are relevant, what's the connection, how easily can you connect the dots. All right, from here on in, we begin to change our focus, not so much on the ordinary garden variety case, the ordinary rule, but we start looking at modifications to that rule, situations in which we don't require the plaintiff to meet that test, but instead we say, well, in your case, plaintiff, we'll give you a different test. We'll accommodate you, so that you don't have to meet the standard we've set for ordinary cases. Your situation is different. And these exceptions turn out to be extremely complex and doctrinally involved. So we figure, okay, in this circumstance, this rule according to this case, you know, these elements, et cetera, et cetera. And inadvertently, because of the amount of time we spend on all of these exceptions, you can become convinced that virtually every case involves one or more of these exceptions. And while you won't face any of these questions on the exam on Monday, you will undoubtedly have something in December in the exam then, where you're going to be looking for causation issues. And I often have students who are just convinced, well, if it's a tort case, and if it's on one of DeWolf's exams, it's going to involve one of these, it's got to be one of these exceptions. It's either a, you know, market share liability theory, or it's a concert of action, or it's something else. It's a loss of a chance, or it's a whatever. And you don't want to do that. You don't want to assume that just because you've spent all this time learning about all these exceptions that every case involves one or more of them. The intersection collision where somebody runs a red light doesn't involve anything more than the ordinary but-for causation test. But that having been said, we now plunge into this world of exceptions and doctrines. And the first one we have here is Summers versus Tice, which falls under this heading of, first of all, saying there is there's negligence, but we're having trouble identifying the person who's responsible for the injury. And again, Summers versus Tice sort of illustrates this in a rather vivid way. Ms. Richardson. So the best practices for quail hunters is to stay in line. But when the plaintiff gets out of line, he gets shot. Okay? So here we are, plaintiffs in, the, as you say, this, not a love triangle here, but I guess a sort of a shotgun triangle, as it were. And the problem is that the plaintiff can't tell where the pellets came from that caused his major injury, the loss of his eye. So what does the plaintiff ask the trial judge to do? Well, let's just pause there for a second. The defendants, in effect, say, plaintiff, it's your burden to establish, unless you can tell the jury that it was me or my co-defendant, you failed to meet the test. The same test applied to Mrs. Reynolds after she falls down the stairs. Mrs. Reynolds, can you convince the jury, more probably than not, that I, the defendant, caused your injury? If you can't persuade them, more probably than not, you lose. And the plaintiff in this case says, I can't meet that test because I don't know. So what does the plaintiff say the trial judge should then do? Okay, and procedurally, you would call that what? Well, what's going on there where the plaintiff says, in effect, it's the defendant's job to, we've shifted the burden of proof. Instead of it being the plaintiff's burden to show which defendant shot him, the burden is shifted to the defendants to say, if you can persuade the jury, for example, the plaintiff may testify that at the time he was shot, he was looking in this direction with essentially the back of his head toward defendant number one and the right side of his face facing defendant two, and that's the that's the eye that he lost, and based on that testimony, if that's where he was facing when the shots were fired, it seems much more likely that the injurious pellet came from defendant two rather than defendant one. But that's for the defendants to work out amongst themselves, as you were saying, rather than the plaintiff having the burden to show which one caused the injury. Okay, now, in terms of this shifting of the burden of proof, did anything from your previous study of the law come to mind? What did this sort of bear a family resemblance to? Where have we heard this story before? Yeah. Isn't it like, what is it that sounds like res ipsa to you? Right, at least in some versions of res ipsa, you have the same shifting of the burden of proof. You have the same situation in which the plaintiff is ignorant of some aspect of the case, and we sort of give the plaintiff this dispensation from the ordinary burden. The difference, of course, is that they are sort of a mirror image of one another. In a res ipsa case, we know the defendant caused the injury, and we infer negligence. And what do we call this, by the way? What's the legal theory or the label we apply to this? It's actually sometimes called the rule of Summers versus Tice, but the other sort of generic label for this doctrine, we see it later referred back to in Sindel. What do they call this? Yeah, alternative liability. So, trying to remember where I was going with that before I wanted to have a label on it. But oh yeah, again in res ipsa we know causation and we infer negligence. Here in alternative liability, we know the defendants were negligent, but we shift the burden to them in effect to establish causation or to refute the presumption of causation. So again, the difference between the two is which of them we know and which of them is missing. I might refer you back to the notes following the res ipsa cases where there was a reference to this case called Ibarra versus Spangard involving a medical treatment where the plaintiff wakes up after an operation with nerve damage because apparently some hard object was placed under his shoulder while he was unconscious during the operation. And the plaintiff asks for and is permitted to, or the trial judge agrees to, shift the burden of proof from the plaintiff to the defendants. And interestingly, in Ibarra, the plaintiff doesn't know who caused his injury, which person put this hard object under his shoulder, and doesn't know that any one of them was negligent. It's likely that one of them was negligent, put this hard object under his shoulder, but the plaintiff doesn't know which one. And yet the court allows this shift of the burden of proof. Notice that in a case like that, we have something unusual, namely that the defendants are, in effect, operating as a team. Although legally they're distinct, the nurses work for the hospital, the doctor is an independent contractor, nonetheless, we can say, for purposes of the surgery, that they're, well, one big happy family. So there's something kind of unusual that allows that, essentially, ignorance on both fronts, both with respect to causation and with respect to negligence. Ordinarily, we have to know one and then use that, in effect, to leverage ourselves with respect to the other. Now, what are the requirements for alternative liability? If you want to use the rule of Summers versus Tice, what do you have to satisfy the court that you're ready to prove? Just as with res ipsa, you can't just say, well, I don't know what happened, but I'm going to argue res ipsa. You have to show you meet the criteria for res ipsa. For alternative liability, there are criteria. Ms. Rush? Well, but it's proximate cause we're struggling with. That's the part where the plaintiff wants, in effect, the dispensation. But what was the first thing you said? Are we inferring negligence, or have we observed negligence? But remember, even if we don't know that either of these guys actually fired, or which of them fired the pellet that took the plaintiff's eye, we do know that they were firing first and asking questions later. And you can say that behavior was negligent. So what is it about alternative liability with respect to negligence that Ms. Riley... Okay, and you're actually moving on to another element. I wanted to nail down just to clarify this idea in terms of negligence, Mr. Tomich. Okay, all of the defendants are negligent. So again, the first part of an alternative liability theory is I can prove all of the defendants were negligent. And notice the difference between this and a case in which I don't know who caused my injury. I know that somebody was negligent, and I don't have the ability to identify which one. So if I walk out in the morning and see that my car parked out in the street in front of my house has been sideswiped by another car, and, gee, there's blue paint from this car that hit mine. And I say, well, I know what I'll do. I'll go down to the courthouse and file a lawsuit against all the people that own blue cars and say, one of you hit my car. And I leave it to you to sort out which one. But logically, I don't think you can do that, you would say, and correctly so, because I can't meet that first thing of showing that all of the defendants, all the people with blue cars, were driving negligently. Whereas here, in Summers versus Tice, both of them admittedly fired in the direction of the plaintiff. They both acted negligently. And it's the problem with causation that we're having. Okay, so now moving on to the next requirement here. Ms. Riley, what was that you were saying again? We don't need to say they're all equally negligent, but you, what you said before. Okay, I thought what you said earlier was something along the lines that any of them, in effect, could have caused the injury. A better way to say that is, in effect, the injury that the plaintiff suffered was one that was within the scope of what the defendants were the scope of the negligent act committed by each of the defendants. And in effect, what we wind up with, oh, no, that's not what I wanted to say. I'm getting confused by what you said earlier. Basically, all of the parties who could have caused the injury are in court, have been named as defendants. We're dealing, in effect, from a full deck. The situation in Summers versus Tice is not, I'm out one day hunting and I get shot and I don't know who shot me. I know these people were in the neighborhood and firing. I know that there are only these two hunters in the neighborhood and it had to be one of the two of them. Again, that's critical for alternative liability. The one who caused my injury is among the ones who have been sued. And therefore, we say almost by by logical implication, therefore, the responsible party is one of the defendants. Again, by logical inference here, all the defendants are negligent. One of them caused the injury. I have within this set one of the defendants, and therefore the burden of proof shifts. Burden of proof shifts to the defendants. Now, again, the choice of using alternative liability, as we see in Sindel, depends upon the confluence of these different factors. I've got to be prepared to show that all the defendants acted negligently. In Sindel, that turns out to be true. But the second problem we have in Sindel is more difficult, and that is to show I know the person who caused the injury is among the defendants I've been able to sue. And if I can't meet that criterion, then I don't know that by holding the defendants presumptively liable, letting them sort it out, I will have the responsible party in my grasp, so to speak, or within the court's grasp. Now, it may be that the defendants can, through their own evidence, shift the burden of proof or persuade the jury, it wasn't me, it was this other guy. It may be that the defendants can persuade the jury they weren't negligent. By using this theory, the plaintiff doesn't establish the defendant's liability. It simply, as the expression goes, shifts the burden from the plaintiff to identify who caused his or her injury to the defendants. Again, in this way, it retains this parallelism to res ipsa. Just as res ipsa shifts the burden to the defendant but still allows the defendant, if they can, to talk their way out of it, similarly, alternative liability shifts the burden of causation to the defendants, allows them to explain, no, it really wasn't me, here's why. But if they can't meet that, they can't satisfy the jury, they can be held liable without the plaintiff needing to identify which one caused the plaintiff's injury. I want to say another thing here just by way of kind of anticipating something. Eventually, when we get to Sindel, we talk about market share liability. We talk about different forms of imposing liability. That is, sometimes it is limited to the defendant's contribution or percentage share. Sometimes, as in alternative liability, the liability is joint, so that each defendant is liable for the whole injury. We'll take that up when we do the follow-up to Sindel, but I want to kind of get you away from worrying about that for the moment, because we take that issue of joint liability versus percentage liability, individual liability, we take that up in Chapter 6. It turns out to be an extremely complex, difficult, policy-driven issue. For the moment, I want to make sure you understand the difference between these different theories, such as alternative liability on the one hand, concert of action, enterprise liability, market share liability, that you have some way of identifying what's unique and distinctive about each theory. Questions about Summers versus Tice or about alternative liability before we plunge ahead? Sindel is a very good case to read. It's very complicated, very long, but it provides a great review and almost sort of law school hypothetical exercise in distinguishing what's unique about each theory and how it applies. So we'll pick up with Sindel tomorrow.